Well, tonight's study is on the subject of Andrew, and hopefully it's going to be a bit shorter than normal because we started late owing to our long-lasting barbecue. So we're going to try and just have a look at the life of Andrew, though, and at the end of that I'm going to get you to write one or two things down by way of personal notes for yourself. And so the section that we've looked at, of course, in the first chapter of John is about the time when Andrew was first called to the truth. And what we're going to find is that Andrew as a person was very different to his brother Peter. In fact, they were both from Bethsaida, weren't they? We know that from chapter 1 of John here in verse 44. Philip was of Bethsaida, the city the city of Andrew and Peter. So in fact, they came from Bethsaida. What does Bethsaida mean, by the way? Anyone know what Bethsaida means? House of something. Very good. Very good. Yep. Yeah, house of fish or fishing. So that was a good place for fishermen to live, I suppose, really, wasn't it? To live in Bethsaida. And they were fishermen by trade, weren't they? Because we're told that in Mark chapter 1 and verse 16. And in fact, they both lived together in the same house, Mark chapter 1, verse 29. So here you've got two brothers that grew up together, and yet for all of the fact that they'd grown up in the same household, they were in fact very, very different people. In fact, if you come to Matthew chapter 10 just for a moment, we notice that in the record of Matthew, that Andrew was originally paired up with his brother. Notice the careful way that the record speaks here. In Matthew chapter 10, it says in verse 2, "Now the names of the 12 apostles are these," and then you'll see that little semicolon there. And then we've got the first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, and then a semicolon, and then James the son of Zebedee and John his brother, and then a semicolon, and then Philip and Bartholomew, and then a semicolon, Thomas, and so you see how that Matthew's record actually breaks the apostles into groups of two. They were actually sent forth in lots of two here, and Simon Peter and Andrew were first linked up. But when we come to Acts chapter 1, which of course comes right through now to the end of the ministry of Christ and to the first chapter of Acts where Christ has now ascended into heaven, we see that the the place that Andrew takes is now different, because in Acts chapter 1 verse 13 it says, "When they were come in, they went up into an upper room where abode both Peter and James and John and Andrew, Philip and Thomas Bartholomew." And Andrew's name now appears after Peter and James and John, and in fact alongside Philip. And whilst we haven't got time, we're not actually going to look at Philip this time, but Philip's a very interesting study, and Philip and Andrew were the best of friends. So although Andrew started off with his own brother, he ended up in fact getting on better with Philip. Now that actually tells us something about Andrew's nature, because what do we know about Philip? Anyone tell us what we know about Philip? How would you describe Philip? How would you describe Philip the Apostle? I'd like to have a stab at that. He was shy, yes? He was. He was very shy. In fact, so shy that most people say, "Philip, yeah, what was he like?" And that's why you don't know much about him, because he was so shy that Philip was always at the back of the group. Very, very retiring person, Philip. Very, very shy. Now, that actually tells us something, I think, about Andrew, because, you see, why would Andrew get on well with Philip? Unless there was some kinship, some friendship, because they were both perhaps of a similar nature. And, you see, I think that Andrew was of a quieter and more restrained nature himself. He got on just fine with Philip, who was shy anyway, but he found it difficult to work with his big brother Peter, because, well, we've already seen Peter was loud and noisy and confident and boisterous, and Andrew wasn't like that. He might be He might be Peter's brother, but he wasn't the same sort of person. Andrew was a quieter person, and so it ends up that he actually pairs up with Philip and gets on very well. And yet the funny thing about this is, although Andrew's a very quiet person, when he first appears before us in the record in terms of something important about him, he in fact is right at the very forefront of all the apostles, and that's in the reading we had tonight in John chapter 1. So come back to John chapter 1 and let's just have a look, because this is actually the key to Andrew's life. You know, every one of these disciples has a key, and if we can find the key, then you suddenly find that the whole record starts to open up wonderfully. Now here in John chapter 1 we're given the key, the index, to Andrew, because on this one single occasion, never afterwards, but on this one occasion, he was the first of all the apostles. Now John 1 verse 35 says, again the next day after John, that's John the Baptist, stood, and two of his disciples, and looking upon Jesus as he walked, he said, "Behold the Lamb of God." And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. Now remember, we've already said that we believe the two disciples were Andrew and John. Well, we know one of them was Andrew, because verse 40 says, "One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew." So definitely Andrew, probably John, because John is writing the story. They both had a brother to go and find, but John doesn't say, "By the way, I was the other one." You know, when you're writing your own gospel, you tend not to do that. And so John doesn't mention particularly that he was the other disciple involved. Now, verse 38 says, "Then Jesus turned and saw them following, and saith unto them, What seek ye? And they said unto him, Rabbi," which is to say, being interpreted, "Master, where dwellest thou?" Now, do you think that Andrew really wanted to know where Jesus dwelt? Is that what he really wanted to know? What did Andrew really mean when he said, "Master, where dwellest thou?" Did he particularly want to know what house Jesus lived in?
His
origin? Any advance on his origin? Well, yes, I think that's probably right. And you see, really, I think what it's saying is they wanted to spend some time with him, didn't they? "We want to talk with you. We want to spend some time with you. Where do you live?" What they really wanted was time to spend to talk with him. We weren't particularly worried about his house. And in fact, it's quite interesting that Melba Perkis says in his book Life of Jesus that probably what Jesus did was took them up into the mountains and showed them a cave to convey to them the price of what discipleship would really cost. "You want to know where I live? Come and see." Where did Jesus live indeed? Good question. Well, wherever it was, they must have had a marvellous day, because verse 40 tells us that one of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, and he finds his own brother and says, "We've found the Messiah." He's really excited by the time that he spent with Jesus on that particular day. Now, I want you to read verse 40 carefully. You see, it's very easy to miss things. "One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother." You notice that? Do you know that out of the 13 times that Andrew occurs in the record, on 6 occasions that statement is said concerning him? Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. You know what happens in life? You say, "Oh, who's that over there, so-and-so? Or, you know, what's that person's name? Oh, so-and-so." "Oh, who? So-and-so. Oh, who did you say they were? So-and-so. You know, such-and-such's brother." "Oh, them." And we make relationships with people based on someone else we know, don't we? Ever found that in life? And we suddenly say, "Oh, I know who they are because, oh, that's so-and-so's brother. Oh, I see. Or such-and-such's sister, or so-and-so's wife." Now, you see what that tells us about Andrew? One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew. Who? You know, Andrew. Who? Simon Peter's brother. Oh, him. And you see, what that tells us is that Andrew didn't have a strong personality of his own. Lots of people didn't know who Andrew was, but everyone knew who Simon Peter was. How would you like it that if every time you're introduced to say something, "Oh, this is so-and-so, this is Andrew, Simon Peter's brother." How would you like that? That was said every time you're introduced to someone. So you see, Peter had to overcome impetuosity, John had to overcome intensity, Andrew had to overcome inferiority. Always being second best to a bigger, brighter brother. That's very hard, isn't it, for some people? He had to be described in relationship to someone else for anyone to work out who he was. No wonder he got on better with Philip. He was a quieter person himself. But in this particular matter, verse 41 says, "Nevertheless, he first findeth his own brother Simon, and saith unto him, We have found the Messiah," which is being interpreted the Christ. Now you see that word "first" there. You need to take a pencil and you need to ring the word "first" or underline the word "first" or do something with it, because that is actually the key word to the whole of Andrew's life. And the word in the Greek is the word protos, P-R-O-T-O-S, protos. And it means to be foremost, in rank, order, or importance. So here's a man who's actually quite shy and quite restrained, but on this occasion he ranks as the first of all the apostles. Now, in what particular way did he rank first? Well, it says, verse 41, he first finds his own brother Simon. Now, what do you think that means? He first findeth his own brother Simon. What do you think that means? There's at least two different ways that we could read that. Yes, well, that's true, and he was on this occasion. But so in a sense you could say, well, he did it first ahead of Peter. Well, yes, he could. Yes, he's going to introduce Peter to the truth or to Christ. Yes, you could say he was going to find others, and the first one he found was Peter. Yes, he was the first convinced of the Messiahship of Christ. And here's a couple of other things. The 20th century New Testament translation says the first thing he did. So he was first in the sense that it was after speaking to Christ, it was the first thing he did. And here's another thing. Bear in mind, you see, John's writing this story. What a delicate touch for John to put in. He first finds his own brother. He beat John. They both rushed off to find their brother. Andrew got back first with his in tow. Simon Peter. So you see, in this particular matter, Andrew was truly the first. And I think verse 41 tells us a couple of very good lessons. In this particular matter, he was first or foremost. He was the first disciple to follow Jesus and the first disciple to introduce someone else to Jesus. He was the protos. He's unique amongst the apostles for that reason. The first of the 12 to follow Jesus, and the first of the 12 to introduce someone else to Jesus, good old Andrew. And yet, of course, in fact, verse 41, another lesson that comes out of that, isn't there, is verse 41 tells us that even quiet people can have a conviction in the truth. He might have been a quiet person, but Andrew was convinced that this is the Messiah. Have we got that same burning conviction as far as Andrew had on this occasion as to who the Christ is? And yet there's something very moving about this story, because verse 42 says that he found his own brother and brought him to Jesus. The Amplified Bible says, Andrew then led Simon to Jesus. And you know, there's something great about Andrew doing that, because what do you think would happen when Andrew introduced Simon Peter, his brother, to Jesus? What would happen thereafter? Yes? Yeah. Andrew knew, didn't he, that the moment he introduced Simon Peter to the Lord, that he would have to take a step back. And Peter would always be at the front. He knew that. He'd grown up with it. They'd worked in the same boat. He'd lived in the same house for all these years. He knew his brother. Now, there's something great about Andrew doing that, isn't there? That here he was prepared, because of his conviction about Messiah, to introduce his brother, knowing that the moment he did so, he would always be, from now on, never first, always second, but always a loyal supporter of the truth and a worker for Christ. There's lots of people in ecclesial life that need to be Andrews. We need lots of Andrews. We all need to be an Andrew in that sense. Now, when we come to Mark chapter 3, and we've already looked at this in the context of Boanerges, remember we said that Mark chapter 3 is actually the Gospel of Mark, but narrated probably to Mark by Peter. So this is Peter's view of where the disciples fit in the story. Now remember how Matthew's Gospel had 1-2, semicolon, 1-2, semicolon, 1-2, semicolon, 1-2. Remember how it paired them off like that? Now look how different Mark is. So you've got to read very carefully Mark 3 verse 1, Mark 3 verse 16, sorry. And Simon, he surnamed Peter, comma, colon, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, and he surnamed them Boanerges, which is the sons of thunder, colon. Oh, and then we have the rest of the apostles. See how that colon tells us that? So we've got Peter, James, and John, and then there was quite a few others. And they all come after the colon. But notice who's first in the list of all the next ones. Andrew and his good friend Philip is alongside. Of course, Philip, by the way, was a good friend of Bartholomew, and so that's why Bartholomew is next. Who's Bartholomew, by the way, in John's Gospel? He's Nathaniel, isn't he? Bartholomew's never mentioned in John's Gospel. Nathaniel's never mentioned in the other ones. And so Bartholomew and Nathaniel, in fact, are one and the same person. So you can see that even by this stage, you see Andrew's already slipped back. He was number one, but he hasn't just slipped back to number two, has he, behind Simon Peter? He's gone behind James and behind John. He's now number four on the list. You see, there was a greatness here about a man who was prepared to accept that position without feeling a sense of inferiority that affected his relationship to Christ and his relationship to his brother. Come and have a look at Luke chapter 8. See how you'd feel about this. How would you feel if you were Andrew? Luke chapter 8. Remember the story of the raising of Jairus' daughter. Actually, Luke 8's a really interesting story. No, we won't have time to digress, but a good supper time story is Luke chapter 8. And about the raising of Jairus' daughter and the woman that had the issue of blood. Anyway, we know that we're told in verse 49 of Luke chapter 8, while he yet spake, there came one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, "Thy daughter is dead, trouble not the master." But when Jesus heard it, he answered, saying, "Fear not, believe only, and she shall be made whole." Now, if you read the Gospels carefully, you'll find that what happened was, Jairus came to Jesus and said, "My daughter is dying, can you help me?" And Jesus began to move off towards Jairus' house, and the record specifically tells us in Matthew's Gospel that all the disciples were trotting along behind Jesus. But when they got to the house, verse 51 of Luke 8 says, when he came into the house, he suffered no man to go in save Peter and James and John. Oh, now can you just imagine being Andrew on this occasion? So here's all the apostles standing outside, and Jesus says, "I'll have you, and you, and you, thank you." Chop, chop, chop. Bang! Left outside. Poor old Andrew. That's always me. I never get to go in. I never get to see all these miracles. Why does it always have to be Peter? You see how easy it would have been for Andrew to feel like that with a brother like Peter? Wouldn't it? To feel that somehow you'd been relegated to a second place. You know, there's no room in the truth for envy or bitterness. No room in the truth for that ever. especially not in family relationships. Got to forget about that. And Andrew had a lovely spirit whereby it never ever worried him. Simon Peter goes in, the door shuts, and I'm left out. Well, that's fine. That's life. That's what the Lord wants. That's fine. There was no spirit of envy in Andrew. That was a lovely thing, wasn't it? You know, there are times in life when we try and be someone else, or we want to be someone else in the meeting. You can't do that, you know. Andrew wasn't Peter. And he had to learn to be like that. But the funny thing is that Andrew did have a certain skill that comes out in the record. And if you come back to Mark chapter 6, we come to the next major occasion where Andrew appears in the record. Actually, it's quite interesting how these little stories work out. Now, come and have a look at Mark chapter 6. Now, in Mark 6, you'll remember the story of the feeding of the 5,000. We're told in Mark 6, verse 34, when Jesus came out, saw much people and was moved with compassion towards them, because they were as sheep not having a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, "This is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away, that they may go into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat." And he answered and said unto them, "Give ye them to eat." You know, remember how I've said before that good Bible study is all to do with good Bible reading. Now, here's another occasion when I think that the Lord had a smile on his face. Because, now see if you can capture the smile. And by the way, I think also the disciples were being a little sarcastic here. You see, what the disciples thought was, you know, good old Jesus, you know, he's a marvellous teacher, but hopeless in terms of organisation. And we've got all these people here, it's 6 o'clock at night, and nothing's organised for a meal, you know? Typical. And I think the disciples really thought that. You see, they thought, well, Jesus was a wonderful teacher of spiritual things, but when it came to the practical realities of running a camp, he really, you know, you wouldn't ask Jesus. Now, just see if you can see that. You read that. You reckon that's right? Verse 35. Read it again. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desert place, and now the time is far past." In other words, it is tea time. "Send them away, that they may go into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread," because, in case you haven't noticed, they've got nothing to eat. You see the disciples saying that? Just a touch of impatience there with Christ. Christ knew what those people wanted. And Jesus said, oh, this is lovely. Jesus said, you see what the solution of the disciples was in verse 36? "Send them away." Jesus says, no, verse 37, with a little smile on his face, "No, give ye them." And then stood back to see what they would do. Oh, Jesus knew exactly what the multitude needed. Yeah, you see those two contrasts there? Send them away, no, give ye them. And the disciples had to learn that the man who was able to minister the bread of life was also more than capable of delivering the natural bread as well, when circumstances arose. And verse 37, they said, "Well, look, shall we go and buy 200 penny worth of bread and give them to eat?" Actually, remember there's a parable in Matthew chapter 20 about labourers going into the vineyard. What was the hire for a day? 1 penny. So what's 200 pennies? 200 days. Now, by the time you take off Sabbaths and Pentecost and Passover and you know, the blowing of trumpets and all the other holidays that they had, that was probably about a year's salary, wasn't it? 200 days, 200 working days, about a year's salary. And the disciples said, "Look, we just haven't got that sort of cash." And he said, well, verse 38, well, you know, what have you got? How many loaves have you got? Go and see. And when they knew, they say, 5 and 2 fishes. But you see, the interesting thing about that is that it didn't happen quite like that at all. Because if you come to John chapter 6, John 6 adds a couple of details that only John has. John says that it wasn't all the disciples that said, we haven't got 200 pennies to buy. John specifically says it was actually Philip that said that, because the Lord had called Philip out to ask Philip the answer to the problem. You notice what happens in John chapter 6 and verse
5, Jesus lifted up his eyes and saw the great company and said unto Philip, Philip. And Philip goes, Philip. No, no, you, Philip, but me? Yeah, Philip. Now, Philip, where are we going to buy bread for all these people to eat? Any idea why he asked Philip, by the way? This is all a bit of a digression, but it's quite interesting. Why did he ask Philip? Sorry? Yes, because he was from the area. Could you prove that? Well, the answer to that is, yes, you can prove it. Remember how it said in John chapter 1, verse 44, that Philip was of Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter? Well, we're told in Luke chapter 9 and verse 10 that this desert that they were in was belonged to a city called Bethsaida. So they were in a desert place, but alongside the city of Bethsaida, and Bethsaida is where Philip came from. So Jesus says, Philip, out you come. And poor old Philip comes out. Philip hated to be out the front. And you see Philip squirming away there, feeling all prickly and horrible. And he said, now, Philip, you live in this area. Where would it be a good place to go? And Philip says, phew, we 200 pennies wouldn't be enough. And so Jesus says, well, you better go and find out what you've got. What you've got. And remember how Mark said that they all went to find out. And they came back and they said, oh, there's 5 loaves and 2 fishes. But they didn't all come back with the answer, did they? Only one disciple came back with that answer. And guess what his name was? Verse 8. His name was Andrew. Who? Oh, Simon Peter's brother. Now you see, there were 5,000 people that day. In fact, it's more than that. It was 5,000 men, wasn't there? There was a lot more than 5,000. And 12 disciples were asked to go out and search for food. Go out and see what you've got. Now go these 12 disciples, whoop, out into the crowd to see what food, what resources there was. But only one disciple came back with the answer. And his name was Andrew. And you see what the answer was? Verse 9. There's a lad here which has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. But what are they among so many? Now you see, all the disciples had searched, but only Andrew brought the lad to Jesus. You see that word lad? Actually, it means a little lad. He was only a wee tacker, they'd say. He was just a tiny top. And you see, I think what happened here, you see, there's an indicator. You see, Andrew was a very friendly, approachable person. He might not have the personality of Peter, but he was a very friendly sort of chap, Andrew. You felt that you could talk to him. Just, you see, if you imagine all these disciples driving off, there goes John, all intense, off to find some food. Here's Peter, barging his way through. Oh, don't get him away now, boy, I'm busy. This little boy goes up and he says, now, which one will I choose? He says, he looks like a nice man. He goes running up to Andrew and he says, please, sir, I've got some food. And Andrew, you see, who was a friendly person, says, what do you got there, lad? And he says, 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. Would that be enough? And so Andrew says, that'll be just fine, son. He puts his hand on his shoulder and he says, now you come along and we'll take that to Christ. Now come along. Now don't be frightened. Come along. Can you see him do that? You see, Andrew was a friendly sort of person and he was good enough. You know, later on, there's a cognate word for little lad used in Mark chapter 10, verse 13, which we won't turn up. Remember, there was an episode later on when the little children tried to come to Jesus and the disciples turned them away and Jesus said, what did he say? Suffer the little children to come to me. There was one disciple, he didn't have to tell that to him. Because there was one disciple who already had suffered the little children to come to Christ, and that was Andrew. And he was the one who came along with his hand on the boy's shoulder and said to Christ, Christ, there's a lad here that's got some food. Mind you, of course, even Andrew didn't know how Jesus was going to sort the problem out with just this little basket, but Andrew thought that something could be done. And so he brought the lad on that day, and a miracle resulted because of that. John chapter 12. Verse 19. The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, Perceive ye how ye prevail nothing? Behold, the world is gone after him. Now, there's a paragraph break there, isn't there, verse 20? And there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. What were Greeks, by the way? Is that Greeks or Grecians? Who were the Greeks? The Grecians were the Grecian Jews. The Greeks were devout Gentiles, proselytes of the gate, as they were, and that's quite right. Now, you see how verse 19 and verse 20 connects when you think carefully. You see, the Pharisees said, "Perceive ye how ye prevail, and behold, the world is gone after him and among them which came up to worship." You see how that verse 20 is very neatly a fulfillment of verse 19? Pharisees were worried about the world going after Jesus, and the earnest of that was that here were some Greeks, some strangers coming already to worship in verse 20. Now, they were Greeks. They were Gentiles. Now, that's a bit of a problem, because although they were earnest, they were Gentiles. What did the Jews think of Gentiles? Dogs. Unclean was another word. Whenever a man became a proselyte of the gate, amongst all the other ceremonies that he had to get involved in, was they always insisted that Gentiles be baptized. You know why? Because they were Gentiles and they needed a jolly good wash. That's true. That's what the Jews thought. That's what Peter says, remember, in Acts chapter 10. Remember the vision of the unclean meat. He goes to Cornelius, he says, "God show me that I should call no man common or unclean." That's how they thought about Gentiles. And you see, there's a real problem here, isn't there? Because you see, these men were devout. They'd come up to worship. They wanted to, well, what did they want? Verse 21. "The same came therefore to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, Sir, we would see Jesus." So they were respectful, weren't they? They called Philip, "Sir." Nothing rude about these people. They were very devout, and they wanted to, well, they didn't just want to see Jesus, did they? They wanted to have time to talk to Jesus. They were devout Gentiles. They'd come up to worship. Now, Philip, well, Philip's even shyer than Andrew, and Philip says, "Oh, crumbs, I don't know. Where's my good friend? Hey, Andrew, quick, come over here." And over comes Andrew to have a chat about the problem, and Philip puts the whole problem onto Andrew and says, "What are we going to do?" And so verse 22 says, Philip comes and tells Andrew, and again Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. So which of those two took the lead in going to Jesus? It was Andrew. You can tell by the record, can't you? So Philip comes and tells Andrew, and again Andrew and Philip, in that order, go and tell Jesus. So Philip says to his best friend, "Look, what are we going to do?" Andrew says, "Well, come on, we'll go and ask Christ." Philip says, "Well, could you do it?" Andrew says, "Yeah, that's all right, come on." Well, and they go off to talk to... Now, you see, why do you think they approach Philip, these Greeks? Any thoughts on that? Yes, yes, and he had a Greek name. Philip's a Greek name. So they thought, well, he'd be a likely chap to talk to about talking to Jesus, because he's Greek, got a Greek name. And by the way, Andrew's a Greek name too, just to really make it interesting. So these two disciples came together to raise the matter with Jesus concerning the Gentiles. Now, you see, I think there's something greater about this than we first imagined, because, you see, this was an advanced understanding concerning the relationship of Gentiles to the truth. Andrew made a decision here. We would see Jesus. Now, what are we going to do? Andrew says, "Yes, I believe that these Gentiles ought to have the opportunity of association with Christ," and he took the matter to Christ. Even Peter didn't understand that, did he? Peter's the apostle later on that Paul's going to tell off in Galatians chapter 2, because his Jewish prejudice was so strong that he even then couldn't really fellowship the Gentiles properly. And he struggled with the idea that they ought to be associated with the things of the truth and with the salvation as it was in Christ. Andrew didn't have a problem. Gentiles want to see Jesus? Andrew stops, thinks and says, "Yep, I think that's okay. Let's go and have a talk to Christ." You know where I think Andrew got that from? Andrew was a disciple of John the Baptist, wasn't he? And he would have heard the words of John the Baptist in John chapter 1, "Behold, the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world." not just of Jews. Now, in case you're wondering what all this is about, let's just think about this. You see, have you seen the theme in Andrew's life? Now here it is. In John chapter 1, Andrew brings Peter to Christ. In John chapter 6, Andrew brings a little lad to Christ. In John chapter 12, Andrew brings the Gentiles to Christ. He first finds others. Remember that statement in John 1? He was the protos. In what way? Well, you see, he found his work in the truth. He might not be a speaker, he might not be a leader, he might not be an administrator, but there was something Andrew was very good at. He was very good at personal conversation with others on the truth, and he was excellent at bringing people to Christ. He found his own job in the truth, and in that particular matter, he was protos. He was specially a fisher of men. And every time he occurs in the record in that way, he's busy bringing someone else into contact with the truth. Isn't that lovely? And you see, here was a man who was never going to be in the inner circle of Christ's intimates. He was never going to be one of the three, was he, really? But there's no resentment, there's no envy, there's no malice, there's no ill feeling, there's no inferiority eating Andrew out, just a quiet getting on with what he could do in the truth. Isn't that good spirit? He wasn't worried about Peter. Wasn't worried about John. What can I do for the truth? Well, I can talk to people about the fact that I believe we've found Messiah. He's excellent at doing it. Now, I think that's a really tremendous lesson that comes out of Andrew, because the lesson here is the greatness of a person who didn't try to be someone that he wasn't, was quite happy to accept a lesser place, but found his work in the truth. Now I want you all to take out a piece of paper and a pencil, and I want you to write down what your work in the truth is. Have you found it? 2 minutes. Isn't that the lesson of Andrew's life? He found his work in the truth. What's yours? Do you know what it is? It's not enough to just be in the truth. What do you see as something that you could do in the truth and do well? How can you serve the truth? What contribution can you make? What's your work? Okay, 2 minutes. By the way, you're allowed to write down more than one thing. Okay. Hands up those that did get something down. Be honest. Hands up those that didn't get anything down. Be honest. Now, you see, I think there's two things here. Those that didn't get anything down need to go away and say, well, yeah, what do I do in the truth? Have you thought about your skills? We don't think about our skills in a proud way, do we? We don't say, yes, I could do. No, we say, look, there needs to be a quiet appreciation to say, well, is there something that I'm good at? Is there something I could do that's useful for the truth? Far too many in ecclesial life drift through ecclesial life and sort of walk in on a Sunday and out again, and then on a Wednesday and out again, and never ever really think about what they're contributing to the truth. Andrew found something he was good at. Now what is that for you? Now if you didn't get anything down, then you probably will find that you are lacking a sense of commitment to the truth and a sense of involvement in the truth in terms of your own personal labours, and probably because of that, a sense of maybe mild dissatisfaction. You're not really doing much. Well, it's time you sat down and had a quiet think about that, isn't it? Now, for those that did write something down, I suppose that all those people need to say, well, am I doing it? If that's what my work is in the truth, could I really honestly say that I'm doing it? And am I doing it to the best of my ability? And is there something else I can do to improve myself, to develop myself, to help me do that job? Is there a study I should be doing that would help me in that direction? What parts of the Bible should I be absorbing to give me a better degree of strength or ability in that particular direction of my work in the truth? Hands up those that can say, within 10 seconds, got to get this timing right here. Okay, within 10 seconds, what specific job do you want in the kingdom? Alright, 10 seconds are up. We've got about 4 people who know what they want to do in the kingdom. How many people have we got here, Gwen? So what's 4 as a proportion of 80? Pretty small. In other words, what's the kingdom? Is the kingdom a sort of nice, rosy, sort of lovely something that's going to happen in the future? No, the kingdom is a whole apparatus of government demanding a whole set of specialist skills. Have you ever applied for a job? Job specification. This job or that job. The following requirements will be there. Those job specifications will be there in the kingdom age. There'll be all sorts of jobs to do in the apparatus of Christ's government. Do you want to apply for any of those jobs? Well, what are you doing about developing your skills for that job now? Have you worked out what the specification will be? Are you working? Are you developing in that regard? Now, all I'm saying, you see what I'm saying, is that we need to have a sense of focus in our life in the truth. What exactly are we contributing into the truth? Why has God called us to the truth? What can we do for the truth? How do we see our life in the age to come? Is it simply going to be a sort of, you know, one feast to another sort of thing? Or are we going to do something specific in the kingdom? Do we have an objective of something we'd love to do for the truth? I think we were talking about this the other day. Can't you see Paul charging around, organising a bit of gospel proclamation? And never having to go to bed at night? Marvellous. Can't you see David there organising the temple choir and part of the arrangements for the worship in the temple? And oh, David will enjoy that. Really enjoy that. What will Jeremiah do, do you think? What do you think Moses will do? Now, don't you think they'll all have specific jobs? Well, what's our job going to be? And before we can answer what our job is going to be in the kingdom or what we'd like to be in the kingdom in the mercy of the Father, well, what's our work in the truth now? Have we found out what that is? So, those that didn't get anything down on their piece of paper, go home and have a quiet think about that. Those that did, ask yourself, well, am I doing it? And what do I need to do to better develop myself towards fulfilling that objective in the truth? And that's surely the lesson of Andrew's life. Mark chapter 13, he was a person who didn't try to be Peter, wasn't eaten out with aiming to be something he wasn't. He simply found his own thing in the truth and got on with doing a good job of it. And Mark 13, by the way, is just a nice little close-off to the story, which says that on a later occasion in Mark 13 verse 1, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples spoke to him about the temple, and verse 3 says, and as he sat over against the Mount of Olives, over against the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately. Oh, and for the first time, Andrew was invited into the circle of the innermost three. I'm sure he treasured that day. Can you imagine Peter sitting there, lapping up every word? If you ever want to know about the Olivet prophecy in the kingdom, ask Andrew. He'll remember every word. Because on that day he was there with his big brother and James and John, the inner circle of three, and Andrew was there listening to that. Oh, he would have enjoyed that. But it didn't eat him out if he wasn't there. There was a wisdom there in the life of Andrew. You know, there's a hymn that we have that says, this is the spirit of the man, isn't it? Concerning Christ our high priest, the names of all the saints he bears engraven on his heart, nor shall the lowliest saint complain that he hath lost his path.